Okay. Well, thanks everyone who remained. We know it's been a long day. When Nicholas called me, he said, "You're the perfect, I know the perfect guy for this job. Someone who can ask insightful questions, can have a scintillating conversation for an hour." And my response was, "Why, Bob Burke isn't available?" But evidently, you're stuck with me. But we have a great set of panelists today. Most of these guys are pretty well known. We have two guys in new seats, and we'll let them talk about that. But very quickly, we've got James Jang from Aegis Capital, Amit Mehrotra from Deutsche Bank, Nikolai Dyvik from DNB. Then we got, who do we have next? Chappelle. Thank you. I couldn't see who was next to me. Jonathan Chappelle from Evercore, Randy Giveans from Jefferies, and Mike Weber, formerly of Wells Fargo, now of Weber Research & Advisory. Mike, did I get that right?
Yes.
So before we start, thought maybe we give James a quick chance to give us a 30-second overview of his new seat at Aegis, and then Mike's going to do the same on his new venture.
Sure. Thanks, Ted. So my name is James Jang. I'm the head of Maritime and Special Situations at Aegis Capital. So Aegis Capital is more of a retail-focused shop. We have about 400+ retail brokers, founded back in 1984. A little different from our prior seat where there was a little more institutional focus. But with the market cap size, I think this is a nice platform for the shipping sector, especially for most companies in the small to micro-cap space.
Thanks. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. So most of you know me already. We left Wells Fargo in July to form Weber Research & Advisory. Two of my colleagues are here with us today, basically taking what we did at Wells Fargo, moving it off balance sheet and covering the space independently. So from a look and feel perspective, it should be very similar to the research and the consulting work we did at Wells. But yeah, that's the general premise. Well, smaller balance sheet, unfortunately.
So no bought deals for Weber Research & Advisory. Shouldn't look to you for that. Okay. Well, let's dive in. Sort of picking up on the last panel, obviously something that's topical for the industry is IMO 2020. And as many are aware, various companies have taken very different approaches. From no scrubbers like Euronav, all in like Sting, or a mixed strategy like those of us at Dorian, as we're pursuing at Dorian, rather. So we'd like to hear from the analyst panel. How does that filter into your valuations, your buy, sell, hold recommendations as you look across the whole range of shipping companies that you cover? So Amit, you look like you got a good answer. Go ahead.
Thanks, Ted. Well, first, thanks for Nick for inviting me here again. It's great to be here. I think just with respect to your question, I've been sitting here all day, and there's been a lot of panels where analysts or other people are asking, "What do you think rates are going to be next year?" Well, the answer is nobody really knows. I think ship owners and public companies and private companies, what they can control is their balance sheets, their operating leverage. And I think focusing on what they can control is really the main point. And what you need to do as a fiduciary of a public company and of your partners. With that being said, with respect to Ted's question, I think it's been a long time, actually, since I can remember, decades, that there's been a real demand catalyst. And IMO 2020 is nothing but a demand catalyst for the tanker industry. There's certain limitations on the supply side as well vis-à-vis dry bulk. But it's actually quite an exciting thing when you can really point to a big demand catalyst in a fragmented industry like maritime shipping. And if the supply dynamic can be held relatively in control, at least in the near to midterm, never is over the long term, that demand catalyst has an ability to really drive outsized returns. And if you can overlay that with the proper risk management vis-à-vis normalized loan-to-value, spot coverage versus some cover coverage, we think there's a lot of equity value to be created in the tanker sector. And so that's when we've focused over the last year and a half. And I think that demand catalyst is really kind of the more fundamental discussion point with respect to IMO 2020.
So it doesn't play a role in your valuation of stocks?
I'm sorry, what's that?
I said, so does it play a role in your valuation and your recommendations?
Oh.
A company strategy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think you know, we have chosen, obviously, I think with a lot of people here, to be positive on the tanker industry. We think product tankers are most directly exposed to some of these IMO 2020 trends. Certainly crude tankers are as well, just germane to the product tanker industry. So, you know, just very, very elementary, you know, the largest product tanker company in the world is Scorpio Tankers, and that's been kind of the horse that we've backed for the last 2 years. The largest crude tanker company in the world is Euronav. We've backed that for the last several years since Deutsche Bank took it public back in 2014 here in the U.S. We've backed that stock. So I think that there's some, and it's nice to see some, you know, some of that coming to fruition, albeit for other reasons. But we think fundamentally, both those companies are quite well positioned, and they have now market caps above $2 billion for both of them, which is also positive in terms of the scope that, for institutional investors to be involved.
Great, Nikolai. Go ahead.
We put a separate line in all our NAV calculation what the scrubber is worth, and if you make an NPV 5 years and you assume the ship owner would retain, you know, 75% of the spread, then you would have a 10 million value of a scrubber today, which is three times the cost if you order a new ship, and so we include it in our valuations. And it's a side investment. It's not shipping. If you have a $90 million VLCC, and you get the average rate past 30 years, you would have, which is 40,000, you would have 8 year payback. If you order a scrubber, current spread, you probably have less than a year payback. So it's a good investment, but it's not shipping.
Jonathan,
we haven't applied any premiums yet. I think we're waiting to see how the spread plays out, what the scrubber premium is, if time charters are willing to compensate the owner for the capital risk that they put up. You know, to answer the first question about, you know, how we look at the companies with the scrubber strategy, I think you need to look at each company's fundamental thesis separately, agnostic to scrubbers, and then add that on to a different, you know, part of the valuation model. But, you know, 3 months ago or 4 months ago at another industry conference, we said we were completely agnostic to that strategy. We were more focused on what Amit was talking about, which is the demand dynamic and the supply dynamic, which I think is more important than he gives it credit for. However, I think we'd be naive to think that there isn't a valuation discrepancy today in the market based on that strategy. And you know, Amit brought up Euronav. When you run the sensitivities on these VLCC rates that we've seen right now, you get the most torque to that fleet. However, it's been one of the worst performing stocks. Now, worse is a relative term. It's only up like 65% in the last few months. But I do think there's a penalty box associated with that strategy of being averse to scrubbers at this point. I think we'll see how it plays out. I understand the NPV math that Nikolai's doing. I think to do a 5 year or 10 year calculation on an investment that may or may not be antiquated in a year or two's time is pretty academic and not real world, but we'll see how that plays out. But right now, I think that you have to focus on the industry fundamentals. Thanks for coming, Robert. And right now, we're pretty positive on the crude and product side.
Well played. Randy?
Yeah, he's gone, so we can say how we really feel. The same thing. We're giving scrubber premiums to those vessels with scrubbers, especially for earnings next year. You know, on a VLCC, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 a day. On a MR with a scrubber, maybe $1,500, $2,000 a day, right? On the asset value, we are given a similar premium, maybe $4 to $5 million for a V, and two and a half, maybe a little less for an MR. So yes, we're certainly giving them, baking those into the valuations. Now the stocks, right? Some. It's hard. Some with a lot of scrubber exposure, Starbulk, for example, on the dry side, or Frontline with their Fiend Marine investment and other things. Maybe that's why they're getting a 80% premium to their peers. But look at Nordic American Tankers. They have no scrubbers, and they're getting a 80% premium to their peers. So I don't think the market's really saying, all right, you have scrubbers, you get premium. You don't yet. But I do think those will differentiate as the spread progresses at $250, $300, $350, $400 a ton in the first quarter.
Yeah. I don't think it really matters, honestly. I think that the stuff like this, I like to work backwards. And if you think about why is someone going to get a premium for having a scrubber, it's going to be based on some sort of TCE alpha. The last time I can remember somebody actually getting a premium for TCE outperformance would have been back in the Frontline OSG days of 10 years ago. where there was a sustained degree of outperformance from an operating pool versus another. You know, we certainly incorporate it into our NAV. You know, I tend to think they don't make a ton of sense for highly triangulated trades, but you know, that's open to interpretation. But in terms of what's going to actually drive the stock, I know, like, you know, somebody mentioned Euronav underperforming a bit recently. I think that's, there's a lot of things going on there, and it has performed relatively well. So I don't know that we necessarily attribute that to a differentiated scrubber strategy. But no, ultimately, it's all noise. And I actually kind of find it amusing that we spend so much time like hand-wringing what could be $50 to $100 million of capital investment on a $1.5 to $2 billion fleet, where there might not have been as much hand-wringing on when we entered that asset market and what our cost basis is on the underlying ship. It's a lot of time spent on scrubbers when it's kind of the tail wagging the dog.
Can I add a comment? We upgraded tankers in February this year, and we made a new note in September. And in that time period, Frontline went up 75% and Euronav went up 3%. So why is Euronav up now? That's since now it makes sense to have ships on the water and not at the scrubby yard. So all of a sudden, the coin has flipped, and now actually having ships on the water matters. So
Euronav also turned over their CEO during that period too.
I wouldn't be quoted to put that as a reason for the share price jump, if you say that. But then I think at least scrubber matters in terms of valuation. But now focus changed to have fleet on the water. I guess if you look 12 months ahead, focus will be on CO2 emissions, and then the scrubber debate would be quite different.
So, James, you have anything to add?
I don't think scrubbers make that much of a difference in terms of valuation. You know, I was speaking to a ship owner today. They're talking about, you know, with a scrubber fitted vessel, I think SSY put out a report saying a cape size with a scrubber is 2.5 million times more valuable, which I don't understand why. That's really more of a sunk cost. Unless charterers are demanding vessels in a certain class be scrubber fitted, what is the real benefit? So if you're chartering it out, you're not realizing the full spread as a ship owner. You have to split that with the charterer. And unless you're operating on spot, that's all you're receiving is that spread. So in terms of valuation, if you're looking at NAV or an asset value right there, the $2.5 million or the $4 million that you use to install a scrubber, I think it becomes a sunk cost, and it doesn't really factor into valuation.
If I could just chime in, if it's okay. You know, we are seeing possibly scrubber-outfitted companies change their time chartering strategy from time charters to voyage charters as a way to try to capture or arbitrage that spread. But just beyond that, you know, I think the key for valuations and scrubbers is that, you know, scrubber cash flow should not be capitalized, because I think there's a fairly wide consensus of people that are a lot smarter than me on the oil and refining side that say the spread will not last in perpetuity. And I think that goes back to what John or Mike was saying. And so if the spread lasts 6 months, 12 months, that's great, but I don't think it should be capitalized in the valuation of the companies. What it should do is generate free cash flow or surplus cash flow to delever the balance sheet of the company that does accrue to NAV. And so the way I think about it is that it accrues directly to NAV, and the multiple you put on those cash flows is 1x as opposed to capitalizing it at a higher multiple.
Well, I mean, if you go back to, let's go back to Robert, right? His whole thing back in 14 about eco-class MRs, this is going to be a wave. You know, how many of you put a valuation multiple because somebody has a MUI duct installed or they have, better paint on the hulls, right? So these eco-class things that are supposed to help you capture fuel savings, how much of that is baked into valuation of vessels now?
It's never the same. I would argue that you did have a collapse in the commodity complex back then that, you know, made fuel efficiency less of a point. But I take your point. But yeah.
Well, go ahead, Nikolai. Do you have something you want to add?
I think at least name one investment where you can have a 1 year payback and you're not going to add any value beyond the 1 year.
So, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead, Mike. Sorry. Well, since you guys have all raised it, let me ask one sort of survey panel of the question. What will the spread between HSFO and compliant fuel be at the end of 2020? James?
End
How much dollars a metric ton?
Well, which port are you talking about?
Oh, good. The average of Rotterdam, Singapore, and Houston. How's that?
I'll say about a 125 to 150.
Okay.
Well, if you look on Bloomberg, there's actually a ticker where you can look at the 2021 spreads, FLSPDY 20, yeah. FLSPDY 21. Right now, it's $250 per ton on average for 2020. But I think it'll be a tale of two halves, Ted. I think, you know, the spread has the potential to widen out pretty significantly in the first half and then narrow. And it'll be interesting to see how the market discounts that narrowing as you progress through 2020.
So give us a number for year end then.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say on average 250, potential to be 3 to 4 in the first half and kind of 1 to 2 in the back half.
Okay, Nicola.
I'm a shipping analyst, not a commodity analyst, but 250 probably fair.
Okay, John.
Zero, for absolutely zero clue. Nobody has any clue. And that R2-D2 ticker that Amit just said, I'll guarantee that's not what it is. Anything but that. Oh. It'll be wrong.
Oh, that's good. That's an interesting bet. Good.
We expect it to stay above $200 a ton every day next year. So by the end of the year, 225.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, I agree with John. I don't think anybody has any clue, but I would say it's dangerous modeling and anything north of 150. Some sort of investment case predicated on that wide of a spread that long.
Okay, so that's an interesting mix, but I think, to Nicolai's point, right, you get a return. In most cases, you're going to get a return as a ship owner at most levels. Obviously, not at zero, but if it's a pretty high first half of the year, is Amit posits, no matter what happens in the second half of the year, you do pretty darn well. So, interesting. So, because you guys raised it, Amit and James both touched on valuation. Look, as a CFO, you know, we understand you guys laid out all this stuff, but given the rates that we're seeing in many of the energy shipping sectors in particular, still seems to be a lot of focus on NAV. You guys all mentioned NAV, but Amit, you also said, well, I wouldn't capitalize the cash flow. You know, so why shouldn't shipping companies trade an EBITDA multiple at this point?
Because the EBITDA is not sustainable. I mean, it's a cyclical industry. So if in a cyclical industry, the multiples are very low at the peak and very high at the trough. And so, if you want to trade at EBITDA multiple, you trade at 1x current EBITDA and you trade at 10x 2017 EBITDA. So I think you can trade at EBITDA implicitly. I think with shipping inherently, the cash flows are highly unstable. I have a lot of fundamental issues with NAV. I have for 5 years. NAV is inherently a flawed concept because what it assumes is that you can sell the entirety of your fleet on day one. And of course, that's theoretical. And also, the asset values are volatile, which is why stocks trade on a premium or discount to NAV. So sometimes analysts will say, well, it's cheap because it's a discount to NAV. For like a year, that happened in 15 ahead of 2016 with respect to dry bulk, when all the market is trying to tell you is that every day the company's losing NAV because they're burning cash and not generating TCEs above their break-evens or operating expenses. So I think NAV is the best we have, but it has to be overlaid by a reasonable risk assessment of the stock. And by the way, all this is in the context of a weak market can be the best friend for a shipping company. Look at Euronav. Euronav bought their fleet in 2013 from Maersk twice, and then bought Generate, of course, during a pretty weak crude tanker market. That sowed the seeds to a lot of where they are today. So in some ways, a well-capitalized company, the weak market, it can be your best friend because 2/3 of your cost structure is tied to when you acquired the asset.
Okay. But go ahead, James.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, NAV, I brought this up on the container ship panel, too. NAV, I think for investors, they don't care, right? It's, we can talk about discounts to NAV, but everybody's trading at discounts to NAV when the market's bad. Another interesting thing we should probably look at is what kind of cash flow can you generate from each vessel, right? So if you look at the universe right now, Euronav has Vs, Seaways has Vs, and you look at, what kind of cash flows that can generate? That kind of tells you who has a better chartering desk, who has better operating operating efficiencies, how strong the management team is. And if we can quantify that, I think that gives a better view of what a value.
But a lot of them are in the same pools, yeah. Like international seaways.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying the pools, right? Because, but even with the pools, there are points that are attributed, yeah. Right? And that goes to the quality of the vessel, right? And so you can kind of find a way to get a better valuation method. But like Ahmed said, I agree. You know, NAV is kind of the default for all of us, and then the the EBITDA multiple also. But if you look at the EV side, you know, debt isn't the same. If you have a company with $10 million debt with a bullet due in 12 months versus a company that doesn't have a bullet due for 3 years, that's a different valuation methodology. All right. So I agree, it's flawed, and we need to do a better job. But, you know, I agree with Ahmed, NAV is probably not the best way to go.
I'm sorry. I think NAV is all we have. So no, I use
hang
NAV.
Hang on, guys. It's Mike, important. I'm going to, Mike and Randy, both you guys, whoever wants to go first.
No, I disagree with that. I think the reason EBITDA multiples don't work is that there's been so much historical volatility that if investors want to assign a historic peak and trough multiple range, the trough multiple for the space is zero. Right, so that you can't say I'm going to buy this group because it's a 4x EBITDA. It just doesn't work like that. And in terms of NAV, like we try to look at NAV within context. So we try to run a trough NAV and a mid-cycle NAV using 10 and 15-year-old historicals. So you can get a sense of NAV in and of itself is relatively meaningless. But when you're looking at where current NAV is relative to mid-cycle and then where the equity is, you can have a bit more context in terms of making that decision. I would also say that in terms of NAV being imperfect, that's just a function of how you're calculating it. I mean, there are going to be trading frictions in terms of actually being able to liquidate a fleet. But ultimately, that asset value is the present value of the future cash flows it would generate, right? You're talking about the same pools of cash, right? So if you're getting to a markedly different number on an NAV basis versus an EBITDA rate basis, one of those two metrics is wrong, and it's probably not going to be the DCF-based NAV metric you're running with. The delta would be whether you think the management team and the platform actually creates ongoing value, but that's why we can put multiples on NAV. So I typically hear that EBITDA pitch from corporates that would like the loftier valuation, because when you put an EBITDA multiple on, a relatively peakish number, you're going to get to a better valuation, but it doesn't necessarily mean the earnings streams associated with that vessel are any different.
Yeah, three things about NAV. One, you can compare, using NAV, you can compare across sectors, across industries, and obviously across time series. And that is a very frequent client request. Can you send me a historical NAV model? What do these get to in bad times? What do they get to in good times, right? And it's something we build out. Secondly, as Mike alluded to, NAV includes cash flow and earnings. So we are using that as part of our NAV in terms of a discounted cash flow valuation for the ship. And third, you can't say that NAV's not important. Who has been buying back shares in the last year? 16 of my 30 companies that have been trading below NAV. Who's been issuing shares in the last year? 3 companies that have been trading well above NAV. So NAV is an important factor for these companies, just like they are for investors, just like they are for analysts. Sorry.
You want me to buy in?
Sure.
I think Nikolai wants me to say something. I blame the Norwegians on the focus on NAV. I mean, I've been championing the cash flow metric for a long time, but Randy's absolutely right. I mean, this is what investors care about, and that's who our constituency is. And as a CFO, I mean, that's ultimately who your constituency is too, is the shareholder. So if they're going to be focused on that, and I get what Mike is saying and doing on an arithmetic DCF of what NAV is, but realistically, that is not what it is. It's what a willing buyer and a willing seller are to agree upon. And you can run your DCF for 30 years with absolutely imperfect inputs, because no one knows what rates are going to be next week, let alone in 2050. It's what is someone willing to pay for that ship today? And that's why we do the NAV estimates based off of what the willing buyer and willing seller is in this current market environment, with some very near-term cash flow estimate on top of it. And Randy's right as well. It does serve a purpose. I mean, I do hate it as a base methodology, but whether it's issuing stock, whether it's doing consolidation, using equity as the currency to do it, there are benefits of using that metric. And because the Norwegians champion it so much, and they're the real leaders in the investment thought base, we have to use it as well.
If I
what you wanted to hear?
No, I don't know. NAV does only tell you where you are today. It's like a GPS navigation in the car. If you're lost, you turn it on to find your way home. If 1 quarter rates in LNG was 180 last quarter and the quarter after that 20, how to value on earnings? That's impossible. We don't value on NAV. We look at our supply demand and then we put it in we derive a rate, and that rate gives us a prospect of what an asset value can be and what the future NAV will be. But I'd love to see, you know, you in the US has been focused on earnings and yield. We've been focusing on NAV. But this time it could actually be different. The investor perception has changed over the past 2-3 months. No one's ordering. The ESG sentiment keeps ordering low. New build prices are going to fall, we argue. And the distressed call or shipping has been out of favor. Now favor is coming back. And the cash generation you make now with so limited new orders, actually now could be the time to look at least on cash flows or the dividends that could be paid out.
Okay, so as we're so give us some tips here, as many of our companies, hopefully my own included, are heading into a particularly good cycle. What is it from your perspective that's going to drive, not you've already discussed what drives your recommendations, obviously there are other things that drive you know, investor sentiment as well that are company specific. So talk to us about how you guys think about Amit talked about, you know, balance sheet management. So let's talk about how a firm, how a shipping company should manage its balance sheet, and what should its capital mix be? You know, debt, equity. So
sure.
Take us through your thoughts.
I can start, I guess, and then well, one of the things what investors need is consistency of performance, and so two weeks of sky high tanker rates are going to spark interest, but I think what we need is kind of a consistency to have that sustainability of interest. You know, what's really interesting is the shipping equity markets have really turned upside down in terms of how companies manage their capital structure, at least in the public markets, where you would actually lever up in a downturn, you know, and sell your assets in an upturn and leverage down. And when you look at kind of what's happened over the last 4 years, is unfortunately some companies have been forced to sell assets at the weakest point in the cycle and had to strike their balance sheet or mark their balance sheet to market at asset values that are at cyclical lows. And so what you actually have now, which is quite interesting, is under-leveraged balance sheets at a time when tanker rates are improving. You actually don't want that, because if you think about gross asset values moving up, the leverage to the net asset value is just a function of how much debt you have. And so when Euronav is at 37% LTV, you could argue that they're under-leveraged, and so every 1 percentage point or 10 percentage point increase in asset values doesn't get you that much torque to the equity, where Scorpio Tankers it does. Of course, that's a double-edged sword. So I think that, you know, My personal view is I think 37% LTV is too low. I think International Seaways, I think Euronav is under leveraged. Of course, that's a good thing when the market turns bad. But I kind of think 50 to 60% is a prudent way to manage your capital structure relative to the asset values. And of course, the asset values change. And so it's a little bit of, it's easy for me sitting in my office on 60 Wall Street to kind of critique someone's LTV. It's harder for you, Ted, obviously, to manage that, because I understand that and I appreciate it, but I think 50 to 60% LTV is probably the right, you know, balance between upside to and risk management.
I can't believe that Mr. LTV is talking about companies being under-levered after just saying that he wants management teams to be consistent. I mean, you said yourself, I mean, the rates have ripped in 2 weeks. That is not a trend. So you have no idea what rates are going to be over the next 3 months, let alone 3 years. I think it's very prudent to run your balance sheet in a more risk-managed way. If we've learned anything from the past, it's that over-leverage crushes right. You. 50% becomes 80% in a heartbeat if the market turns.
Right.
So I think, and I saw you were in Tradewinds on like $1 billion worth of dividends. I mean, yeah, you pay your dividends if your balance sheet's in order. You don't pay your dividends if you're at 60% leverage, because you should focus on bringing your balance sheet back to a manageable position when the sun's shining.
Excuse me for a second. I've been around for a little bit longer, so give me some credit. The dividends are paid out as a surplus to beyond debt service and debt repayment. So it's actually neutral to your capital structure over and above your all-in break-evens. So I actually think 50% LTV is actually prudent. Listen, if everybody went out and put 70% down payment on their houses, we'd all live in smaller houses. There's ways to prudently manage your debt levels and maximize your equity value. I think 50% at this point in the cycle is probably the right level. I could be wrong, and this is subjective. So Jonathan's, you know, I respect Jonathan's work. He's been around the industry longer than I have. He's much older than I am, and so I think
still look much better.
His view is prudent. His view is prudent, and it's just subjective. It's a subjective difference.
Well, just if I could jump in. First of all, please. Let's all recognize that Amit gave himself a nickname as Mr. LTV, which is not organic.
I gave him that nickname.
Oh, okay. Well, John let him off the hook. If you look at the name that we cover that gets the single best valuation is going to be Kirby, right? And we have to recognize the fact that for 10 years we've been coming and sitting in this room, and it's been a really shitty decade, right? And the track record of capital mismanagement weighs on the equity valuations. And when you look at the equities that get a premium, they're asset agnostic asset managers with good track records, right? So Frontline, to your point earlier, Frontline's a tough comp for anything because I've seen Frontline trade with a negative $5 NAV trade at $3 for the better part of 2 years, right? Just it's the physical manifestation of a Fredrickson premium. So you have that, and you have a company like Kirby, which happens to sit right on the crossroads between industrials and energy. They've got low leverage, they've got good management, and they're not going to blow up a generalist and industrial investor if things go sideways, and they've got a lot of operational leverage. And I think that typically, and they're running with 20 to 30% net debt to cap. I think that when you look at, if you're looking for premium equity valuations, we can talk all day about the theoretical. If you really want to juice your equity return, you shouldn't stop at 50, right? But we've got to live in the real world, and ultimately you guys are going to be concerned with where your equity currencies are, and the answer has been less leverage.
Sure.
Unless you're Fredrickson or you're someone that is going to get the benefit of the doubt 9 times out of 10. And there just aren't many of those.
And I'll say the same thing. And in terms of my house, yes, I'll put 70% LTV on it, but my house value in Houston, Texas, and the Astros are winning 2-0, by the way. My house value is not going down 20% next year. It's not going up 20% next year, right? Ship values could go up or down 20% a year. So I'm going to compare houses to ships here. Secondly, if you're looking for the next 3-month return, you want 90% leverage. But if you're looking for what's a good investment for 2 years, I know that's a lifetime in shipping, right? 2 years, 3 years, that's why I'm comfortable pitching INSW to my brother and to everyone I can talk to, because their leverage is 25, 30%. They sell $123 million of LNG assets. They pay off $100 million in debt, right? That's what you want in the next few years. But yes, is INSW going to triple tomorrow? No, but that's okay.
Yeah, by the way, Lois and Jeff are right there, so yeah.
I think right there.
Oh, there
it
is. Yeah.
It depends on the segment, if you know, and what you want. Is it the CFO wish or the banker wish or the analyst or the investor wish for leverage or dividends? But if you look at dry bulk rates past 10 years, they've been averaging $11,000 a day. That's 4,000 below cash break even. But in those 10 years, there's been multiple ways to play the assets. And if you then have low leverage and try to capture asset swings, then you know the share price doesn't work that much. That's why I think we've seen such a differential in share price performance across the crude space this year, since you've seen some with high leverage benefiting so much more than those with low leverage, when asset values have gone from the low 80s to 100.
Yeah, but you were 60% levered 10 years ago, and I know that we were coming from a different era. The way to play assets at that point was through bankruptcy court. So that didn't turn out very well for anybody. We're just saying you try to manage the ups and the downs. And I agree, pay a ton of dividends, buy back your stock, do whatever you want with excess capital. You're right, Amit, above and beyond interest expense and debt service. However, if you levered up during the downturn or for acquisitions or whatever, you need to proactively then use free cash to get yourself to a manageable position to play through the next cycle.
You definitely need discipline. You're right. Yeah, for sure.
All right, so I'm going to take a little more extreme view. If being on the public markets is, being able to have access to capital, have your share price appreciate, have investor interest, I would say all the shipping companies during this upturn to take all their cash that they need and de-lever and go to zero, right? And then take all that, and then once you have zero leverage, take all the excess cash flow that you have, do an adjusted basis with some cash reserves for fleet renewals in future and pay that as a dividend. If you do that, as Nordic shown in the past, you'll trade above NAV, so you could issue equity above NAV, so you're not diluting shareholders. You can access the capital markets freely, use that cash with capital reserves in a downturn and make strategic acquisitions. As long as you have zero leverage, you have that ability to turn on that faucet, which is the dividend, which is going to have investor interest. So That's extreme, right? But if the goal is to be a public company and to kind of outperform your peers, what else can you do? Because, you know, all the ship owners here, they're price takers. They don't dictate the market. And so to stand out and take the investor dollars, especially in this market environment, you should look to deleverage as much as you can.
I think if I could just say what James is saying a little bit differently, you know, I think public ship owners are worried and concerned about their currency and how can they use that currency creatively for growth. And so what's interesting is how do you create a perpetual capital base? And one of that ways, interesting, I think one of the themes over the next several years with this hopefully rally that we see is you're going to see shipping companies and specifically tanker companies deleverage their balance sheets significantly to get to maybe that net debt neutral position in the hopes that their price to NAV goes up above 100% like it is today. And what that does is create perpetual capital to grow the fleet. And I think that's a brilliant strategy. It certainly worked for brief time for Nordic American Tankers. I think what you need there is some hype on the retail side. Most of my investors are institutional investors. I don't talk to retail, right? And so at the end of the day, it'd be nice for the market caps to continue to get increased. And, you know, Randy, I agree, International Seaways has a great profile and it's managed very well. The problem I have is that, you know, with the trading liquidity and the relative market cap, you know, how do you tell that institutional investor to buy International Seaways and not buy Euronav? And so it becomes this, well, how do you tell someone not to buy, you know, Starbulk and buy Genco or Eagle or something like that? So sometimes, like, we do need some platform here where all these companies can actually merge into one great company and suddenly you have less options. And I think that's what the market needs, because you do have a risk that some of these smaller companies from a financial scale perspective get a little bit lost in differentiating themselves.
Well, Ted, I don't know about all that, but the one thing we have seen over the last year, this Gaslog did it, and I think somebody else did as well, that's kind of reemerged is the idea of special dividends and keeping a degree of tactical flexibility, just given the inherent volatility associated with some of these rates. The key is you've got to hit people with it a couple times a year, or, you know, to keep them honest. But I generally think that we should see more of that. And I think it's generally a good idea to keep that degree of cash flow flexibility while still returning value to shareholders. So in terms of things we would look for the next handful of years, delevering and then keeping a degree of flexibility with some sort of well-articulated tactical special dividend policy.
Okay, so, well, okay, a lot of good debate there, which was somewhat enlightening. So when we look at all that, you know, we have sort of some interesting inherent contradictions, right? Everybody says, okay, free cash flow is over and above all of your cash cost needs. I get that, I agree with that. We all agree there's some need for reserves. But you all talk about, you know, the need for consistency. So, you know, do you just pay dividends in good times and not in bad times? And to me, that doesn't have a great impact on stock price action. I mean, when our two quoted peers, both Norwegian listed, were paying dividends, they were yielding 28 and 35% respectively. So how do you square that for an investor and a CFO with, you know, this presumably preferred application of excess cash flow back to shareholders? Because it sure doesn't seem to generate much in the way of valuation.
Well, the answer is it just takes time, right? It takes years and years, right? So you use most of that cash flow to delever. You reserve some of it. You hit people with special dividend occasionally, so people know when rates are improving, they've got to anticipate a special dividend coming from Dorian. But I mean, there's no magic bullet, right? But yeah, when you've got a fixed dividend and you're yielding 30%, right, you've kind of boxed yourself into a corner that might not make a ton of sense. But yeah, there's no magic answer to it.
There's good examples of companies that have sustainable dividend payout ratios. I mean, look at Euronav. You know, people peg their dividend payout ratio to book earnings, which is interesting dynamic because depreciation is such a large piece of the P&L for shipping companies. And so when you peg your payout to book earnings as opposed to cash flow, what you do is you create some buffer because theoretically depreciation should be offset by capital reserves and capital investment. So I think that there's ways to do that in a way that's sustainable. But then there's also bad actors. I mean, look at TK Tankers. I mean, they and Mike Weber really called them out on their conference call, right, for pulling their dividend, and kind of retail investors were banking on that when they could have paid it. And so I think that sometimes one example of bad acting can paint the industry with a big broad brushstroke. And part of our job as equity analysts is to kind of differentiate those guys from the guys that are trying to do the right thing.
There were many ways of being consistent. If you look at the DHT and Euronav, they've been consistently making counter-cyclical investments and positioning their balance sheet to make counter-cyclical investment, and both have done it twice in the last two downturns. So it's not, I think over time, if you manage to play the balance sheet so that you can do counter-cyclical investments, I think that will at least... That shows that management is on top of where the market is, and it also makes sure that your share price doesn't go down 90% if you're wrong on the market call.
And I think he mentioned DHT. That is a prudent way to do it in our view. Pay off, in their case, I guess 60% of net income in either share repurchases or dividends. Obviously, it's floating, but I think in that way, I've had investors say, I'm only doing DHT because I know I'm going to get some money back at the end of the year, all right? So whatever the case may be, in the bad times, right, they might only get a penny, but in the good times, getting 60% of big earnings in fourth quarter, they know they're getting money back.
James, you have something?
Yeah, so Ted, I mean, you asked as a CFO, how do you think of this, right? So you should know what you have a projection on what your fleet, your cash needs are gonna be for the year based on your fleet, regardless of the rates, right? And so based on your earnings, you have an adjusted net income or an adjusted cash flow, and use that as your reserves, right? Just to make sure that you can pay out a dividend, let's say the next quarter is a little soft, right? But if you have a reserve there for that, you can have a consistent dividend. The worst thing to do is cut the dividend or pull the dividend. So if you have a floor and you know that you can meet that, you can issue a special dividend each quarter, and investors will know, this is the floor, and based on what the market is yielding, this is additional payout that we can expect. And in that way, you're not tricking the investor, and you'll have consistent following. And based on that, you just trade above NAV and issue equity for any future vessel purchases.
Yeah, so CFO, that all sounds really nice. But
it's easy, right?
Really easy.
The best comp for this is probably like Diana from the middle of the decade, right, when they were getting a pretty healthy premium to everybody else in an admittedly difficult market, purely because they made a single decision towards the peak of the last cycle to start delevering, bring their debt down to zero. And they lived off that for about 7 years, right, in terms of a premium valuation. So I think absent developing the kind of asset agnostic manager reputation that, say, a Frontline has, that's the cleanest path towards getting a premium valuation, de-risking the story.
Well, so, and also, because you guys sort of talk about depreciation representing sort of replacement value. In actual fact, the way the ship lenders think about it is that your depreciation should equal your annual principal amortization. So if I follow the math, paying out too much net income, I've got to cover continued debt pay down, and I've got to cover capital reserves.
Well, I didn't say pay out too much of net income.
I understand you didn't say that, but how do you formulaically take that? Because you're telling us to formulaically communicate something to shareholders so they can give us some credit for it.
I'm telling you to be consistent. I'm not telling you to create a formula, okay? And so, like, for example, Euronav gives themselves wiggle room by saying, this is gonna be the payout, and unless we have a really good acquisition opportunity, we're gonna pay it out, but if we don't, we're gonna use some management discretion. So, like, I think you guys control the company, you're 100 times smarter than we are from an operational perspective and a financial perspective. We're looking at it from outside in. So there's gotta be some benefit of doubt that the market has to give to the managers. And I think that, that's definitely key. But what I don't like to see is companies that have stated payouts and decide to cancel it for willy-nilly reasons. I think that's really detrimental to the industry. And so this all goes down to holistic. Like, there's no formula. And so NAV is a point in time. Someone mentioned they have to overlay it with capital structure. James mentioned principal repayments and the risks there. So there's no formula, which is why you guys have a tough job. But I think the industry is kind of suffering from a couple bad actors. and you, the good guys, you guys are paying the price for it. And my hope is over the next year or two, you know, that goes away, and you know, the guys that have been good guys or girls that have been good fiduciaries actually end up getting the credit that they deserve.
So going back to our discussion about valuation and NAV, and NAV implicitly including cash flow, should a dollar of cash flow retained, because it's in the model, right? It stays in the company's balance sheet. The company's investors still own it. Be valued equally with a dividend?
No. Well, it depends on what they do. So that's a great question. And you know, Warren Buffett talks about this all the time, is that the NPV of a dollar in dividend is a dollar. The NPV of a dollar retained and done something accretive with it could be quite significantly more than a dollar. So it's a great point. And so if you tell me, Ted, or someone tells me that, listen, you know, we're not going to give this out in dividend because we've got all these NPV accretive way in excess of our cost of capital, who am I to say that's a bad thing? That's clearly the right business decision. I think that everything has to be DCF'd out, and whichever has the highest NPV needs to, you know, that's where the dollars need to go.
The person that's made the most in shipping has paid out lots of dividends, and that's John Fredrickson.
No, or away. Yeah, I think that the Warren Buffett analogy is very interesting because he has a plethora of investment opportunities. What do you have as a ship owner?
Yeah.
Ships. That's it. And what are you going to do? You're going to rush to the shipyards and order a bunch of ships? Are you going to buy secondhand ships that probably aren't really available? Because unless you have a distressed counterpart, you're not buying at the top of the market. And at the bottom of the market, no one really wants to sell either. So, I mean, you guys have done some consolidation, and I think your peers have as well. But especially in a niche industry like LPG, your acquisition opportunities are pretty limited. So it's a different kind of dollar argument, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, if you're talking about the dividend part versus cash for your NAV analysis, like, you know, we mentioned, if you are a consistent dividend payer, let's say you pay out a dollar in dividend, you know, that, what is the effect on that in the future for your share price, right? And if that affects the share price to go higher relative to your NAV, isn't that more valuable than a dollar saved on your balance sheet?
And Ted, you know, I think it also takes a lot of discipline from your side too, from the management side, because in shipping, capital is always available at the worst possible time. And so for you guys, and you need to, who, you know, people love to buy ships in the industry and they want to go to parties in Piraeus and say how many ships they own, et cetera, et cetera. It really takes a lot of discipline to say, no, we don't want that capital right now, even though it's available to grow our fleet, because typically when that happens, it's at the worst possible time.
But you know, and to that point, because we've talked about it a lot, you know, talk to us about, you know, how you look at you know, capital structures. You know, Scorpio from the outside has one of the most complex capital structures out there. You know, with all sorts of different, you know, preferreds and converts and all sorts of other good stuff, and right, sale leasebacks and everything else. You know, versus others who have a more straightforward, you know, bank debt heavy kind of structure. So how do you, you know, is a dollar of principal repayment in those analyses treated the same?
It should. I mean, at high level, you can get fancy about, you know, dividing up the stacks of debt, but at the end of the day, it's debt and it's equity. And so a dollar paid down in debt accrues to your net asset value. So I agree, it's more complicated, but it's not that hard to draw up a schedule.
It isn't, but how do you think about it from an investor perception perspective?
I just don't think they get that in the weeds on it. Okay. I think what we've done is looked at quarterly repayments between now and end of 2020 for all the companies we cover. And one thing about Scorpio Tanks, a little tricky, is that they've got a lot of refinancing of balloon payments. And so like that $17,000 a day of break even, we've said on the record, is a little bit misleading. Now they do have a pretty young fleet, so it's probably too draconian to assume that they're not gonna be able to refinance those balloon payments. So I think that it depends on what lens you're looking at it and where you're coming from, but you have to do that work.
Yep.
Ted, the devil in the details in terms of your question around both handling amort with the distribution and what Amit was just referencing is the amortization holidays that are typically thrown into most of the companies that have, you know, relatively simplistic capital structures. So from your perspective, it's relatively hard to make a decision on where your payout level should be for the next 2 to 3 years when you've got, you know, a pretty healthy maturity coming at you in 4 years, right? So Costamare is a company that's done a relatively good job of kind of flattening out their amortization profile so that you actually can make a decision in terms of payout with a relatively consistent view of what your cash outflows are really going to be.
Yeah, well said. I don't think anyone's looking at the complexity. Investors we speak to are mostly concerned about, you know, net debt to cap, some leverage ratios, and weighted average cost of capital or weighted average interest rate, right? Not necessarily, do they have sale leasebacks or preferreds or, you know, the, if they have preferreds, it's likely to be a lot higher than bank debt, LIBOR plus 300, whatever. So I think that's the bigger drivers.
Having a presence in those markets is definitely important, but there you can definitely go too far. I mean, you look at C-SPAN's capital structure, it's an effing nightmare, right? Like, to try to come up with. So, like, there are definitely companies out there that people just don't want to spend the time on because it's going to take way too much time to get to figure it out. But that doesn't mean that, you know, having a presence, you know, Gaslog is a pretty big presence in the pref market. You know, you can make the case that right now in the energy space, the only way you can really value investors on the credit side anyway. I think it does, to a degree, open you up to a broader investor base, but there is a limit to it.
Good. All right. Well, we're almost out of time, and we're all that's standing between drinks and people. But let's so here's the question: your best stock pick for the next 12 months. Mike, you want to start?
What was the question?
Best stock pick. Your favorite stock for the next 12 months. Oof. And you can't say during LPG because that's obviously the right answer.
Ah, yeah, you took it from me.
Hope it's not Golar.
The next 12 months. I'll go off the menu. I'll go next decade. It's a Greenfield LNG project. We got along our first Greenfield project in 2 years. I think supply push dynamics in the LNG space are going to mean you basically want to get long any project that's going to be going to represent the path of least resistance for gas exiting the Permian. And they trade at the biggest discount to you know, where some sort of fully baked DCF would be. The easy answer here would be something on the crude side, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. But yeah, I think that, you know, on a risk reward basis, I think it's probably the best, the most attractive name on our list.
Randy?
Yeah, this is similar answer. Any tanker, some more so than others, and I've been pretty vocal about those. But if I just had to say what's going to double in the next year, maybe Golar, GLNG.
Okay. Jonathan?
I hate to steal Amit's thunder because he's a reference to Euronav in every single answer.
I wasn't going
to
say Euronav.
I almost feel like he's pining for the CFO role, but I'm going to say Euronav anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Euronav too.
Scorpio Tankers, by far. I mean, Euronav is a great company and we're super positive, but it's like not even a question. It's Scorpio Tankers.
Okay, it's a question.
I guess I'm a little more bearish on the crude tanker side for the next 12 months versus the rest of the peers. I can't actually give a stock because I don't have coverage on one yet. So I'm long on Pyxis Tankers. It's a product tanker company, and they have nice fundamentals, as you know, on the product tanker side. And that's my pick for the next 12 months.
Right. What's the float on that?
I was going to ask.
Okay, moving right along.
I was going to ask Mike Weber.
So can we give a round of applause to our panelists? They did a great job.
Thanks, Tim.